Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, the latest on health and healing, coenzyme Q10 blocks neurodegeneration and shows promise for slowing the progression of Parkinson's disease. The omega-3 fatty acids in periodontal disease, green tea boosts your brain, energizing sick mitochondria with vitamin B3, and why we should all have oregano oil in our home. I'll give you what it does and why it's so important, plus a lot more. From our environmental segment, two reports, one on glyphosate found in U.S. mother's milk, breast milk. That's brand new, just within the last hour. And also, Monsanto trying to muzzle a scientist, not just any scientist, one in the field that they're related to. And we'll give you the latest on that. Also, we're going to take a look at TED. Now, not everyone in this audience will have heard of TED and the conferences they put on. Little 15-minute segments. Ours is only 10 that we're going to play. And you'll hear different people from different walks of life before a live audience giving their perspective. I saw one that surprised me. And it showed their disdain for that which is spiritual, that which is humanistic. It's all about science. Really? So they say all of our truths could only be known by science. And they control the science. And therefore, we shouldn't even give a form to TED or any place else, pay any attention to anyone who's not really 100% scientific. We're going to challenge them. But first, we'll play what this man, who's a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, has to say about why we should only trust people like himself. I think you'll find the response enlightening. If time allows, is college worth it? And also, Obama has not gone after any of the Wall Street bankers. Why? We'll discuss that. And how predatory college loans are bankrupting the financial future of America's youth. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. And if you want to watch this show, just go to ustream.tv, look for Gary Null. Omega-3 fatty acids are important. They can turn off inflammation in your heart, in your brain, in your lungs. Now just think of that. Think of the benefits of every American taking an amount appropriate for their size and age and state of health. For some, that might be 1,000 units a day. For others, it might be, 5,000 units a day. And there are different sources. The richest source, far richer than fish oil, far richer than salmon oil, is chia seeds. Yeah. In fact, chia seed has more protein than pumpkin seeds or sunflower seeds. It has more of the healing oils than salmon as a percentage of its weight. So it's really a powerhouse. But once these oils get into your system, one of the first things they do is they turn off inflammation. So that means if you're the average person, your brain is inflamed all the time by what we eat and drink, our lack or amount of exercise, and our stress levels. Environmental pollutants, all this creates inflammation. Now, we can't live in a bubble and shouldn't, and we don't want to be paranoid about such things, but look, I'm a big advocate of exercise. I'm an athlete. I've won over 600 races, hold world records, national records, track records, state records, athlete of the year for 3 years, the Metropolitan Athletic Congress, the indoors and outdoors. So I really appreciate athletics, athleticism, and character building. But I also know that it creates free radicals, lots of them. So on the one hand, you're benefiting if you exercise, your heart, your lungs, your pulse rate. You're bringing all those into a safer mode. You're reducing body fat. You're detoxifying. You're speeding up the waste out of your intestines to remove itself from the body. You're sweating. That's helping alleviate a lot of toxins, as your skin is your largest limited organ, not your liver, not your kidneys. It's your skin. So by compensating, you do your exercise. Before you do, you take your antioxidants. After you finish, you take your antioxidants. It's simple. So then the compensation benefits from what you did, but eliminates or lessens any negative side effects, meaning oxidative stress. So that's why we should be taking all of these omega-3 fatty acids. Here's one more reason. This is from the Maharishi University Research Center in India. The omega-3 fatty acids, as a host modulator in chronic periodontitis patients, randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. What it showed was, in this very important study, that by taking the omega-3 fatty acids over 12 weeks each day, there was a significant reduction in gingival index, in sulcus bleeding, meaning bleeding gums, and pocket depth, meaning the receding of your gums, which loosen your teeth. And this was not in the placebo group. It was in the group that took the omega-3. From the study, quote, "Dietary supplementation with the omega-3 fatty acids may have potential benefits as a host-modulating agent in the prevention and adjunctive management of chronic periodontal conditions." So we knew it helped all these other conditions I just mentioned, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, heart disease. Who knew that it would also help prevent periodontal conditions? But it does. So for all the holistic dentists who are listening now, and we have a lot, and the people go to them, 1 to 3,000 units of the omega-3 fatty acids each day. Coenzyme Q10, it sure is a wonderful nutrient. You have it in every cell of your body. The older you get, the less your body produces, and statin drugs play havoc because statin drugs will block the coenzyme Q10 ubiquinone from being produced in the cells and utilized. Coenzyme Q10 energizes the heart. That helps prevent heart attacks, especially if those people who are not really in shape start to exercise and put stress on their heart. This helps prevent the heart from overworking and ending up with a heart attack or a stroke. It helps the brain. College students would do a lot better, those who are working on creative tasks or challenging tasks, if they used about 300 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q10. Here's the latest. University of Windsor in Canada. The title of the article is "Orally Delivered Water-Soluble Coenzyme Q10 Blocks Ongoing Neurodegeneration in Rats Exposed to Paraquat, Potential for Therapeutic Applications in Parkinson's Disease," end quote. And this was published in the British Medical Journal of Neuroscience. And it says that in this study, coenzyme Q10 was able to stop the progression of neurodegeneration and was very promising with Parkinson's. Now, the reason that I give the peer-reviewed journal, the title of the article, where it was published, what place it was, because there is an ongoing battle to try to dissuade people from listening to programs such as this, because if you start to realize how much misinformation you have been given, how many wrong things you've been encouraged and propagandized to consume, then you're no longer that special client of the state, of a corporation. You're being no longer corporatized. So they're going to say, oh, there's no truth. Yes, there is. We deal with good truth in a proper context. Use your coenzyme Q10. Help yourself from neurodegenerative disease. Now, one of the largest groups of people in the world, in fact, the two largest groups of people in the world, between the two, they have over 2.6 billion people, of the Chinese and Indians. And some of the largest tea-growing estates in the world are in India. And they've been able to use teas, and most teas are the same. It's the same leaf. It's how it's processed. Green tea, black tea. This is not a green tea that's grown and a black tea that's grown or a white tea that's grown. It's all the same. But it's in the final stages of what they do with it. But all of them have healing properties. There are thousands upon thousands of good studies. And that's why I would like to encourage people in this audience to have a cup of green tea with Manuka honey each day. Be really healing and helpful. This is one more reason. This is from the University of Basel in Switzerland, published in the academic journal Psychopharmacology. Here's what it says from the University Hospital, Professor Christoph Beglinger. Green tea boosts your brain. Now, we know that it has a lot of benefit, but now they're saying that it actually enhances cognitive function, particularly in working memory. Think of the millions, tens of millions of Americans now suffering from some form of dementia. So, we knew that it helped with cancer, absolutely, but now we can add the brain as well. So, you're getting two benefits right up. You're trapping free radicals, which help prevent cell damage, which leads to cancer, and you're helping the brain. So that's good. Take your green tea every day if you're over the age of 40. It can make a big difference in cognition. We all hit that day where we just are tired. No matter what we do, we just seem to be dragging. And one of the reasons is because our little tiny energy factories in the cell called mitochondria simply are not able to create enough energy. A little chemical in the cells called ATP, adenosine triphosphate, helps ensure that we have that. But with stress, that's a big attack against the mitochondria. Pollutants and the food we eat, the polluted water we drink, it all impacts our mitochondria. And that, or maybe we're over-exercising, overworking. So you end up one day with a sick mitochondria. What can you do about it? I mean, like, instantly. This is from the University of Helsinki, published in IMBO Molecular Medicine, which is a very respected journal. Vitamin B3. Yes, the vitamins, the B vitamins, have turned out to be potent modifiers of energy metabolism, especially the functioning of your energy factories in your cells and mitochondria. Now, you have more mitochondria in your brain, you have more mitochondria in your heart than other places in the body, because your heart has to beat every second of your life. Your brain has to process information, stimulation, create hormones every second of your life. So this is important. Something as simple as re-stimulating the mitochondria by generating fuel, ATP, for all cellular functions, for all of life processes. Now, the mitochondria myopathy is the most frequent form of adult mitochondrial disorder. Typical symptoms, muscle weakness, pain, cramps, and there is currently no medical treatment that works. But in this scientific group, they used B3, which is a derivative. It's a nicotinamide, like niacin, riboside, and it delayed mitochondrial myopathy. And the treatment increased mitochondrial mass and function and cured the structural abnormalities. So vitamin B3, really good for your energy. And this is a major breakthrough study. This is not known around the health movement. And finally, wild oregano oil is very important, but most people don't know why. They've heard that it helps if you start to come down with a flu or virus. Indeed, it does. It's also known as marjoram or wild marjoram. Oregano oil is generally found in southwestern Europe, Asia, and the Mediterranean. In the Greek language, it's a combination of two words, mountain, which is Oros, and joy, which is Ganis. And it's used as a culinary spice. It has very distinct flavors and aroma, especially in Italian cooking. But its healing is what is important. There are chemicals in oregano. One is called carvacrol, which is known to be a great antimicrobial agent. It kills all forms of microbes. It can help preserve food, and that's how it's frequently used. I've seen in an Italian village where a person used oregano oil and massaged it into a food that they were preserving. They were very familiar with how it does it. Well, now we know that it kills candida, yeast infections. It also helps to kill Aspergillus mold, Giardia, Staphylococcus, Listeria, Salmonella. Keeps all of that able to be controlled. So that's good. It also contains a compound called thymol, T-H-Y-M-O-L. That's a natural fungicide and an immune booster. I put oregano oil, 10 drops to a gallon, in water and sprayed it on vulnerable plants in the garden. Insects stay away from it, but it doesn't hurt the plant. There's also a class of hydrocarbons known as terpenes, and these are present in oregano also in pine trees, and the terpenes are really important because, again, they're antimicrobial. And additionally, there's what is called rosmarinic acid, which is stronger than vitamin E at preventing free radical damage, can boost cognitive function, and can help prevent allergic asthma. And a flavonoid, which gives grapefruit its bittersweet taste, while also preventing cancerous cells' growth, what is, and I've mentioned this many times on here, naringin, and naringin, N-A-R-I-N-G-I-N, is really strong in oregano. Plus, you also have some trace minerals, but those are minor compared to everything else. So let's just recapitulate. What can oregano do? Well, it's antibacterial. It's an antioxidant. It's antifungal. It's anti-inflammatory. It's antihistamine. Helps with allergies. It fights respiratory illness. It helps with lungs and sinus conditions. It soothes muscle aches and pains. It lessens menstrual cramps, it soothes upset stomach, and it's an immune booster. It's inexpensive, easy to grow, and should be used much more frequently. That's our latest on our health and nutrition. Now let's go to the environmental issues. This is from Catalin Rocket from Boulder Weekly. Quote, muzzled by Monsanto, is Big Ag squelching research showing its new RNAi GMOs may be dangerous? 30 years studying how plants use their genes to defend against viruses, Dr. Vicky Vance, a professor at the University of South Carolina, quote, there's DNA in the world and it gets passed from one organism to another, and it's the natural thing. If that's the problem you have with transgenic plants, it's not a good reason to be against them, end quote. She does, however, have a problem with megacorporations allegedly using their money and power to hide the risks of new forms of genetic technology. Quote, I didn't used to be anti-GMO, and I didn't used to have strong feelings about Monsanto, but that was before Monsanto went after her. But that was before the Chinese also came up with some interesting research. That was also before she got some calls from Monsanto's lawyers. And then she couldn't find research funding. That was all that. Professor Vance is well respected in the world of RNA research. At a conference, major conference, hosted by the International Life Science Institute, a group of academics, regulatory professionals from the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Agriculture's Environmental Risk Analysis Program, and members of the biotech industry gathered in Washington, D.C. they came to evaluate the environmental risks of a promising new technology technique to protect crops against pestilent insects, a gene-regulating process called RNA interference. Well, Professor Vance wasn't just an attendee at the conference. She provided the introduction to the event. She studied small interfering ribonucleic acid molecules, RNAs, in plants for most of her 30 years. She's published many peer-reviewed academic papers. She's led conferences on the topic. So she's in the inner circle. She's one of the top people in the world on what she does. Well, at the time of her being at the conference, Dr. Vance and other attendees were relatively positive, quote, from the conference. No plausible risk hypothesis were identified that can be considered unique to RNA mechanisms when compared to other genetically engineered plants with similar traits, end quote. Here's what she says now. Quote, at the time I was like, yes, it's safe. How is this going to be dangerous? The corn rootworm will take up these RNA, which turn off production of essential proteins and pests. Apparently it works really well. Otherwise, we'd have to use pesticides, chemicals that are toxic, end quote. That was then. But her stance on this technology as a pesticide would change. Here's how. RNA has applications in both the medical world and in agriculture, but these two worlds are not after the same thing when it comes to RNA. And while the medical community is trying to protect processes that will cause the human body to accept modified RNA strands, agriculture corporations working in the GM field are busy trying to prove that their RNA strands can be assimilated by the human body, can't be assimilated, won't get into your body. So if you eat a plant, if you ate some corn, or if you ate something that had this technology, it's not going to get into your body and make a problem. In short, the medical world needs the genetically modified RNA to be assimilated into our bodies, and the agriculture world needs the opposite to occur. So, in September 2011, 3 months after Dr. Vance gave her presentation at this wonderful conference, a team led by Professor Zhang at the Nanjing University in China published a paper in the journal Cell Research claiming that mammals, in this case mice, take up small RNA when they eat plants. And those plants' RNAs regulate expression of mammalian genes, something that science refers to as trans-kingdom gene regulation. Though the team reported finding small RNA molecules in the bloodstream and tissue of mice and humans, they found that one particular molecule of RNA from rice could inhibit a protein that supports removal of low-density lipoprotein, the bad cholesterol, from the blood. Now, if such a finding proved to be true for humans, you're looking at a cataclysmic impact. Think of your cholesterol levels. Think of your bad cholesterol going through the roof. That could kill people. Enormous implications. Quote, that had never been reported before. Nobody had thought about that. What the hell, I mean? You're eating a plant and taking in plant RNAs, and they're regulating the expression of your genes. I think that has to be considered. There's been a lot of resistance to that paper. When something really unexpected like this comes up, there's always a lot of resistance, end quote, said Dr. Vance. Well, resistance was apparent when, before the Chinese study was even published, the team's manuscript was rejected by Science, Cell and Molecular Cell. Professor Zhang told the Scientist magazine it was because their discovery was, quote, too extraordinary. Quote, most of the people who speculate about our work just don't believe it because the concept right now, I have to say, is broken by my results. They don't want to believe until I have new data or other groups reproduce some of mine. Okay, what is the takeaway message here? Let's go back several years. And here's what I said about this field. That once you take a gene and you splice it and you put it into a food or an animal, then it's reasonable to assume that once the human body digests the food, a glass of milk, a steak, you know, a salad, that your cells then could pick up this gene and it could mutate. In fact, there was a whole concept called jumping genes, of how it could jump from one to another, even in species. But we've been told all along that can't happen. No, we may alter the genes to make a cow fatter, but it's not going to end up in your body and it's not going to hurt you. They've been wrong. Every single one of these has been shown that they were wrong. So instead of acknowledging they're wrong, they try to attack the people who are making the science happen, ganging up on them and trying to discredit them in their work. And because we do not have a media that is open, honest, and objective and free, the media will not back the Seralinis, the people who fed genetically engineered maize to rats, and the rats, after 3 months, began to develop cancers, and by the end of their lives, they had massive tumors. All the people in the GM field stopped their experiments at 3 months. Is it because they knew if it went longer, they're going to show cancer, and therefore they would never have their products on the market? So instead of doing the right thing, count upon the companies to always do the political thing. Put pressure on all those politicians, especially those handling committees. Put pressure on scientists who have access to the FDA and think tanks. Put money into the hands of researchers at universities that you control the research because you control the funding, and tell them, come up with a study that debunks this. And that's what they've done. So I just want to let you know the newest research shows not a good idea to be eating anything GMO. Oh, but we have this today. This is from GM Watch Daily News. Quote, glyphosate found in U.S. mother's breast milk. In the first ever testing on glyphosate in the breast milk of American women, civil society groups have found, quote, high levels in 3 out of 10 samples tested, suggesting that glyphosate does bioaccumulate. The world's number one herbicide discovered in U.S. milk. Pilot study shows buildup of glyphosate herbicide in mothers' bodies. Urine testing shows glyphosate levels at 100% higher than in Europe and 1,000% higher than in Europe. Initial testing shows Monsanto and global regulatory bodies are wrong regarding bioaccumulation of glyphosate, leading to serious public health concerns. Testing commissioners urge USDA and the EPA to place temporary bans on all use of glyphosate-based herbicides to protect public health until further comprehensive testing of glyphosate in breast milk is completed. In the first ever testing, Moms Across America and Sustainable Pulse have found high levels. The shocking results point to the glyphosate levels building up in women's bodies over a period of time, which is until now been refuted by other global regulatory authorities and the biotech industry. Quote, the levels found in the breast milk was 16 times higher than in European drinking water directive allows for individual and pesticides. So, once again, it's dangerous. Well, if a mother's breast milk has it, what's that going to do to the infant who's breastfeeding? There's currently no regulatory limit on the amount of glyphosate in breast milk anywhere in the world. However, the EPA has set up a legally enforceable maximum contaminant level for glyphosate of 700 UGs per L in drinking water, which is 7,000 times higher than that in Europe. Way to go, EPA. What a organization. My God. Every governmental organization is completely controlled by special interests. They've been corporatized. So now the bureaucrats become obedient to those who are the policy makers. And the technocrats, they're there to defend the status of the bureaucracies. So one more reason why, if you're breastfeeding, make sure that you go organic in all that you eat and drink. Clear the body as much toxins, and you should be doing this before you're even pregnant. One other thing, is college worth it? Well, there's several things to take into account. I've been talking with many individuals who are sitting at home in their parents' place, and unfortunately, they have degrees. They frequently are anywhere from $30,000 to a gentleman who just applied for a job in my office. $400,000 in debt. How did you rack up $400,000? Well, this particular person went to medical school, didn't like it, and quit, but had all this debt. Now I can't find work. But that's not for everyone. Here's my thoughts on this. There are certain areas where you're much more likely to be able to find a job that pays you a living wage when you get out of college. These are what are called hard subjects. Engineering, for example. Engineering has more jobs than there are people applying. And at the end of 20 years, you will have earned $1.1 million more than had you not had an engineering job. The arts and humanities, well, if you're at the top of your class at Columbia, yes, you'll find work, but a lot of people are not. They end up with good degrees, good backgrounds, and they're not earning enough to sustain themselves or pay off their debt. In the business field, really bad, and in the health science field, good, but the cost of getting these degrees have escalated substantially. And what people do, they say, well, you know, a bachelor's degree today, your debt is $29,400, and most people are deeply in debt on that, and you're going to be spending more for for-profit colleges than for not-for-profit colleges or state colleges. And we have this giant bubble out there, and it seems like a lot of people are benefiting from it. So what we need is we need to take an honest look at our own lives and ask ourselves, if the reason I'm going to college is to get a good education and then go out into the world, what can I do? Do your homework first. Look at all the professions that you are interested in, and are they hiring, and at what price? Are they shrinking? Are the jobs being taken, for example, by a whole new group of people coming in from India, very well educated, and they're willing to work as PhDs in their field for one-half to one-third of what an American would work. And corporations are saying, well, we've got Jim over here, and we're paying him $120,000 a year plus benefits. He's been here 20 years. But we've got this gentleman from India. He's willing to work for $40,000 a year and no benefits. Ah. And suddenly they start making that. And that's going to go across all of these lines. So then you look at the jobs report and you see, well, we hired 177,000 people. Yes, but what kind of jobs? The largest single category, bartenders and waiters. That's not a living job. And then piecemeal work. It's seasonal. And then again, that's not a living wage. Those are frequently near minimum wage. And yet most of these people are college educated. So do your homework, see who's hiring and who's not, which fields, which are growth, which are shrinking. Realizing that manufacturing is being taken out of the United States even more now than in the past. And most Americans are now, who have money, are not making their money by putting it into the, investing in the manufacturing system. They're putting it into capital gains, meaning they're making their money by keeping it into a asset for more than a year, so they get a very low tax on it. So real estate speculation, for example, is one of the biggest. But they're not putting money into a new business, as would historically been. People opening up their own business because the landlords have made it so difficult and the government's made it so torturous. So we need a complete rethink on this. I believe for a lot of people you should be studying sustainable crafts and skills. I believe that will open up millions of new jobs. But that means a whole different look. These things you're not going to learn in your traditional schools, which on the one line is good because you don't have to pay all that cost. And also look at online education, non-traditional education, where you can go on a computer and take classes in the areas that you need. You pay a price for that class, whether it's 1 week or 1 hour or 13 weeks. You learn what you have to learn. Whether it's matriculated or not is irrelevant. Whether it's credit or not is irrelevant. Does it help you? I met yesterday with a person who comes from with a master's degree in business, has an MBA, and has been successful, but now needs to change direction in this person's life. So what did this person do? They learned all about hydroponics, everything about hydroponics, and now is able to go out and do a business on their own or with a group growing hydroponics. I think that's a great idea. So crafts and skills, the things that historically were considered, you know, blue collar, redneck, no. Those are the people that be able to have a livelihood in the future, along with those in medicine and healthcare, engineering, architecture. But otherwise, just to go into a 4-year program today, I wouldn't do it. I absolutely wouldn't do it. You'll be burdening your parents. Remember, you, college student, you're not going to pay your debt. You don't have any money. Someone's going to co-sign for you in most of the cases. Parents who are going to use what they thought was the advantage of their equity in their home. Some will have that equity, some won't. Right now, there are millions of families whose homes is at least 5 million, whose home's underwater, meaning what they owe is more than what the house is worth. They've taken out loans. So they took out loans to pay for education. Now the education is not able to pay back, but the parent is on the hook for it, and they miss a payment. Now they're into compounding interest. Right now, the average college graduate will take 20 years minimum to pay off their debt. 20 years. You miss a payment, watch how predatory they are in coming after you. So college is not for everyone, not today. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going to shift over and listen to what this man believes that the future, the people sharing information, especially at a TED, should really be trusting in science. And I'll have some thoughts on this after you hear what he has to say, because he's not alone. This is going to be happening in a lot of places.
In our culture, talking about the future is sometimes a polite way of saying things about the present that would otherwise be rude or risky. But have you ever wondered why so little of the bright futures promised in TED Talks actually come true? Is it something wrong with the ideas or with the notion of what ideas can do all by themselves? I write about the entanglements of technology and culture, how technologies make certain composition of certain worlds possible, how culture in turn structures the evolution of those technologies. It's where philosophy and design intersect. And so the conceptualization of possibilities is something that I take very seriously, and it's for that reason that I and a lot of people think that it's time that we take a step back and ask some serious questions about the intellectual viability of things like TED. And so my TED Talk is not about my work, my new book, the usual spiel. It's about TED, what it is and why it doesn't work. The first reason is oversimplification. Now, to be clear, I have nothing against the idea of interesting people who do smart things, explaining their work in a way that everyone can understand. But TED goes way beyond that. Let me tell you a story. I was recently at a presentation that a friend of mine, an astrophysicist, was making to a potential donor. And I thought this talk was lucid, it was engaging, and I'm a professor of visual arts here at UC San Diego. At the end of the day, I know nothing about astrophysics. The donor, however, said, "You know what, I'm going to pass. I'm just not inspired. You should be more like Malcolm Gladwell." Now, at this point, I kind of lost it. Can you imagine? I mean, think about it. A scientist who creates real knowledge should be more like a journalist who recycles fake insights. This is not popularization. This is taking something with substance and value and coring it out so that it can be swallowed without chewing. This is not how we'll confront our most frightening problems. This is one of our most frightening problems. And so, what is TED? TED is perhaps a proposition, one that says if we talk about world-changing ideas enough, then the world will change. Well, this is not true either, and that's the second problem. TED, of course, stands for Technology Entertainment Design. To me, TED stands for Middlebrow Megachurch Infotainment. The key rhetorical device of any TED talk is a combination of epiphany and personal testimony. The speaker shares some personal story of insight and revelation, its trials and tribulations. What does the TED audience hope to get from this? Vicarious insight, a fleeting moment of wonder, a sense that maybe it's all going to work out after all, spiritual buzz? Well, I'm sorry, but this is not up to the challenge of the problems that we are ostensibly here to face. They are complex and difficult and not given to tidy, just-so solutions. They don't care about anyone's experience of optimism. And given the stakes, having our best and brightest waste their time and the audience's time, dancing about like infomercial hosts, is too high a price. And it's cynical. Plus, it just doesn't work. Recently, TED Global sent out a memo to TEDx local organizers telling them to avoid booking speakers whose work spans the paranormal, conspiratorial, new age, quantum, neuroenergy, and so forth, what is called woo. Instead, they should book speakers whose work is imaginative but grounded in reality. And to be fair, TED Global took some heat for this, so the gesture should be acknowledged. No to placebo science and placebo medicine. But the corollary to placebo science and medicine is placebo politics and placebo innovation. And on this count, TED has a ways to go. Perhaps the pinnacle of placebo politics was presented at TEDx San Diego a few years ago. You're familiar, I assume, with the Kony 2012 social media campaign? Okay, so what happened here? Evangelical surfer bro goes to Africa. He makes campy video explaining genocide to the cast of Glee. The world finds his epiphany to be shallow to the point of self-delusion. The complex geopolitics of Central Africa are left undisturbed. Kony's still there. The end. You see, when inspiration becomes manipulation, inspiration becomes obfuscation. And if you're not cynical, you should be skeptical. You should be as skeptical of placebo politics as you are of placebo medicine. So, TED. First, technology. We're told that not only is change accelerating, but the pace of change is accelerating. And in terms of the computational carrying capacity at a planetary level, this is true. But at the same time, and in fact the two are related, we're also in a moment of cultural deacceleration. We invest our energies in futuristic information technologies, including our cars, but drive them home to kitsch architecture copied from the 18th century. The future on offer is one in which everything can change so long as everything stays the same. We'll have Google Glass, but we'll still have business casual. This timidity is not our path to the future. This is incredibly conservative. And more gigaflops won't inoculate us, because if a problem is endemic to a system, then the exponential effects of Moore's law also amplify what's broken. It's more computation along the wrong curve. And I hardly think this is a triumph of reason. A lot of my work deals with deep technocultural shifts from the post-humanism to the post-anthropocene. But the TED version has too much faith in technology and not enough commitment to technology. It's placebo techno-radicalism, toying with risk so as to reaffirm the comfortable. And so our machines get smarter and we get stupider. But it doesn't have to be that way. Both can be much more intelligent. Another futurism is possible. A better E in TED might stand for economics, and yes, imagining and designing new systems of valuation and exchange, of accounting for transaction externalities, of financing coordinated planning, and so on, because states and markets, states versus markets, these are insufficient models. Our thinking is stuck in a Cold War gear. And worse is when economics is debated like metaphysics, as if any real system is just a bad example of the ideal. Communism in theory was an egalitarian utopia. Actually existing communism, what meant ecological devastation, government spying, crappy cars, gulags. Capitalism in theory is rocket ships, nanomedicine, Bono saving Africa. Actually existing capitalism is Walmart jobs, McMansions, people living in sewers under Las Vegas, Ryan Seacrest, plus ecological devastation, government spying, crappy public transportation, and for-profit prisons. And yet, the alternatives on offer range from basically what we have plus a little more Hayek to what we have plus a little more Keynes. Why? The recent centuries have seen tremendous advances in improving the quality of life. But the paradox is that the system we have now, whatever you want to call it, is in the short term what makes these new technologies possible, but in the long term, it's also what suppresses their full flowering. A new economic architecture is prerequisite. So D for design. Perhaps our designers, instead of prototyping the same change agent for good projects over and over again, and then wondering why they aren't implemented at scale, we should acknowledge that design is not some magic answer. Design is very important, but for different reasons. Getting excited about design is easy because, like talking about the future, it's more polite than dealing with the real white elephants in the room, such as phones, drones, and genomes. That's what we do here in San Diego and La Jolla. And in addition to all of the amazingly great things that these technologies do, they're also the basis of NSA spying, flying robots killing people, and the wholesale privatization of biological life. That's also what we do. So you see, the potential of these technologies is both wonderful and horrifying at the same time. And so to guide them towards a good future, design as innovation just isn't strong enough of an idea by itself. We need to talk a lot more about design as immunization, to actively preventing certain innovations that we don't want from happening. So, as for one clear takeaway, one magic idea, I don't really have one. That's kind of the point. Perhaps I might venture that if our species were actually to solve its most dire problems, perhaps.
So that's his perspective. I was so compelled by what he had to say that I'm going to set aside time this weekend. I haven't decided when yet to do an entire lecture that I'm going to film on this, because it opened up an entirely different paradigm. This is what you're going to hear more and more of. That what we need is only official science, not placebo science, only official economics that people have to adhere to, not the ability to have wiggle room. Not the kind of the, as he mentioned, we really don't want anymore, and Ted doesn't want anymore, are the people who talk about quantum physics or spirituality, because it's just a waste of our time, and it's all kind of showmanship. There's no reality to it. Really? There's no reality to it? The reality is in the science, the immunization programs, like an immunization from what? It begins tonight. 7 p.m., Progressive Commentary Hour. I'll be having on Dr. Christopher Shaw, Professor of Neuroscience, University of British Columbia, who heads a laboratory that discovered the neurobiological cause of death in girls who got the Gardasil vaccine. Barbara Lowe Fisher, co-founder and president of the National Vaccine Information Center. Norma Erickson, president of SaneVax, to talk about the so-called immunization factor, the mindset, the real science. No, it's killing people, it's injuring people, but that's what he would believe is what we should be going at. Plus, I'll also have Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, and she'll be doing a commentary at 7 tonight on why there is no vaccine ever created from her research as a medical doctor and scholar that is either safe or effective. But I want to read this to you now, and then I'm curious who in the audience will know the author. If you know the author of this, 888-874-4888. Science. Quote, "Let me explain the problem science has with religion." The atheist professor of philosophy pauses before his class and asks one of his new students to stand. "You're a Christian, aren't you, son?" "Yes, sir." So you believe in God?" "Absolutely." "Is God good?" "Sure, God is good." "Is God all-powerful? Can God do anything?" "Yes." "Are you good or evil?" "The Bible says I'm evil." The professor grins knowingly. "Ah, the Bible." He considers for a moment. "Here's one for you. Let's say that there's a sick person over here and you can cure him. You can do it. Would you help him? Would you try?" "Yes, sir, I would." "So you're good?" "I wouldn't say that." "But why not say that? You'd help a sick and maimed person if you could. Most of us, if we could, would do that. But God doesn't." The student does not answer. So the professor continues. "He doesn't, does he? My brother was a Christian who died of cancer, even though he prayed to Jesus to heal him. How is this Jesus good? Can you answer that one? The student remains silent. No, you can't, can you? The professor says. He takes a sip of water from a glass on his desk and gives the student time to relax. Let's start again, young fellow. Is God good? Yes. Is Satan good? No. Then where does Satan come from? The student falters. From God? That's right. God made Satan, didn't he? Tell me, son, is there evil in this world? Yes, sir. Evil's everywhere, isn't it? And God didn't make everything right? Yes. So who created evil? The professor continued. If God created everything, then God created evil, since evil exists, and according to the principle that ours define who we are, then God is evil. Again, the student had no answer. Is there sickness, immorality, hatred, ugliness? All these terrible things, do they exist in this world? Yes. So who created them? The student does not answer again. So the professor repeats the question, who created them? There is no answer. Suddenly the lecturer breaks away to pace in front of the classroom. The class is mesmerized. Tell me, do you believe in Jesus Christ? The student's voice betrays him and cracks. Yes, Professor, I do. The old man stops pacing. Science says you have 5 senses you use to identify and observe the world around you. Have you ever seen Jesus? No, sir, I have never seen him. Then tell us if you've ever heard your Jesus. No, sir, I have not. Have you ever felt your Jesus, tasted your Jesus, or smelt your Jesus? Have you ever had any sensory perception of Jesus Christ, or God for that matter? No, sir, I have not. Yet you still believe in him? Yes. Well, according to the rules of empirical, testable, demonstrable protocol, science says your God doesn't exist. What do you say to that, son? Nothing. I only have my faith. Ah, yes, faith. The professor repeats, and that is the problem science has with God. There is no evidence, only faith. Is that it? The student stands quietly for a moment before asking a question of his own. Professor, is there any such thing as heat? Yes. And is there any such thing as cold? Yes. No, sir, there isn't. The professor turns his face to the student. Obviously interested. The room suddenly becomes quiet. The student begins to explain. You can have lots of heat, even more heat, superheat, mega heat, unlimited heat, white heat, a little heat or no heat, but you don't have anything called cold. We can hit down to 458 degrees below zero, which is no heat, but we can't go any further after that. There is no such thing as cold. Otherwise, we'd be able to go colder than the lowest 458 degrees. Everybody or object is susceptible to study when it has or transmits energy. And heat is what makes a body or matter have a transmit energy. Absolute zero is the total absence of heat. You see, Professor, cold is only a word we use to describe the absence of heat. We cannot measure cold. Heat can be measured in thermal units because heat is energy. Cold is not the opposite of heat, it's just the absence of it. Silence across the room, a pin drop somewhere in the classroom. What about darkness, Professor? Is there such a thing as darkness? Yes, the professor replied without hesitation. What is night if it is not darkness? You're wrong again, sir. Darkness is not something, it is the absence of something. You can have low light, normal light, bright light, flashing light, but you have no light constantly. You have nothing, and it is called darkness, isn't it? That's the meaning we use to define the world. In reality, darkness isn't. If it were, you would be able to make darkness darker, wouldn't you? The professor begins to smile at the student in front of him. This will be a good semester. So what is the point you're making, young man? Sir, my point is your philosophical premise is flawed to start with, and so your conclusions must be flawed. The professor said, flawed? How can you explain? You're working on the premise of duality. You argue that there is life and then there is death, a good God and a bad God. You're viewing the concept of God as something finite, something we can measure. Sir, science cannot even explain a thought. It uses electricity and magnetism, but has never seen, much less fully understand, either one. To view death as the opposite of life is the ignorant fact that death cannot exist as a substantive thing. Death is not the opposite of life, just the absence of life. Now tell me, Professor, do you teach your students that they evolve from a monkey? If you are referring to the natural evolutionary process, young man, of course. Have you ever observed evolution with your own eyes? The professor begins to shake his head. Since no one has ever observed the process of evolution at work and cannot even prove that this process is an ongoing endeavor, are you not teaching your opinion, sir? Are you not now acting like a scientist but a preacher? The student remains silent until commotion has subsided. To continue the point you were making earlier in the other with the other student, let me give you an example of what I mean. The student looks around the room. Is there anyone in this class who has ever seen the professor's brain? The class breaks out in laughter. Is there anyone here who's ever heard the professor's brain? The professor's brain, touched the brain, smelt the brain. No one appears to have done so. So according to the established rules of empirical, stable, demonstrable protocol, science says that you have no brain, sir, with all due respect. So if science says you have no brain, how can we trust your lectures? The room is silent. The professor just stares at the student, his face unreadable. Finally, after what seems an eternity, the old man answers, I guess you have to take them on faith. Now you accept that there is faith and that, in fact, faith exists in life. Now, sir, is there any such thing as evil? Now uncertain, the professor responds, of course there's evil. We see it every day. It is the daily example of man's inhumanity to man. It is the multitude of crimes and violence everywhere in the world. These manifestations are nothing but evil. To this, the student replies, evil does not exist, sir, or at least as it does, not exist into itself. Evil is simply the absence of God. It is just like darkness and cold. A word that man has created to describe the absence of God. God did not create evil. Evil is the result of what happens when man does not have God's love present in his heart. It's like the cold that comes when there is no heat and the darkness that comes when there is no light. I'm Gary Nall. Who said that? Tim from New Jersey.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
It was the same fellow that said the problems that exist in the world today cannot be solved by the level of thinking that created them. Albert Einstein, sir.
1921, God versus Science. You are right. Thank you, Tim. And so, the man from TED, with all the hubris and arrogance and conceit, should pause a moment before he determines that there is no truth except that which is empirically studied and reductionistically examined. Have a nice day, everyone. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Wow, that was great. I have an email here from Cheryl, and she has a PhD, and she says, I, for one, Gary, would be very disappointed if you were to stop broadcasting over WBAI. Now, she says, I know that a fraction of your PRN audience is familiar with the whole Pacifica situation. She says, but understand that you're the shining star of WBAI. Its days are numbered without you. Where else on the radio dial would you ever be able to broadcast an entire hour without commercial interruptions? She says, it's just no one to replace you. And what you do for so many masses of people, I know that you're strong enough to deflect any negativity from Pacifica and lead the charge to reform WBAI for the better. At the same time, I get an email from a gentleman who mentions that recently Summer Reese spent 2 hours on Roy of Hollywood. And his question is, why would she refuse to come on to BAI and offer people to call in with their opinions and their input about what's happening with WBAI? So I wonder if you could shed some light on that.
First, I appreciate the person's positive inputs, but I am not the cause of BAI. We'll have a future. What will allow BAI to have a future is to have new management, a professional program director, probably the replacement of 80% of its programs, a person who is hired as a professional to promote those programs and the station to create a new meaning because the station and the foundation has lost their way. They don't know who they are or what they represent. They don't know who their audience should be. As a result, there are no standards except for those that the individuals themselves may bring onto the show. Some are great, most are not. It must be able to have a different governance system. The current one not only is broken, of which you were a member on the local station board, but is also counterintuitive and counterproductive to everything that has to be for the future of the station. You also should have more autonomy, and from the national movement, because it's a dysfunctional family. Right now there's an effort by the Berkeley branch of Pacifica to take over Pacifica and use BAI as the way of doing it. There are those of us who believe that would be terrible and are doing all we can to stop it. It is now in court, the first step in court, the first hearings on the 14th of this month, a restraining order from allowing those who tried to hijack the Foundation's national board to have control to take that power. My concern is that the stations now will start de-evolving even more. All five stations are dead, and the only reason that they're still alive is because of endless fundraising. So we have to have a whole new rejuvenative mindset, new management, a new sense of governance, better programming, more inclusive, and good public relations to help this effort. That will take about a year to a year and a half, in the very least. And if it has that long, it'll have a future. If it doesn't, then it won't. And it'll be taken over, and a NPR and MSNBC type of programming will take its place, which is principally there to defend the corporate Democrats and Hillary in the next election cycle. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Let's say hello to standing by at a secret bunker somewhere in the south of Florida. Guarded by alligators, crocodiles, and pythons, Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Oh, Gary. From my bunker today, we're talking about the National Urban League, a study in neutral advocacy.
Great. Only from Utrice, the most interesting program in the afternoon on non-commercial radio, and she's here every day. Back in a moment.